purebred killing machine. He said he's waited his whole damn life for this. I knew him well when he was 17. Now he's a man, he'll be dead by Christmas. And so everybody's going to war, but we don't know what we're fighting for. Don't tell me it's a worthy cause. No cause could be so worthy. If love is a drug, I guess we're all sober. If hope is a song, I guess it's all over. How to have faith when faith is a crime? I don't want to die. If God's on our side, then God is a joker. Asleep on the job, his children fall. Just wants to be free. What do we learn but what should not be learned? Too late to find a cure for this disease. So everybody's going to war, but we don't know what we're fighting for. Don't tell me it's a worthy cause. No cause could be so worthy. If love is a drug, I guess we're all sober.
Welcome to the Wrestling Podcast Australia. I'm Katie Zakitman.
And I'm Nick Pendergrass.
Are you though? And we're recording from location known to ASIO. Computers, ASIO's looking at our show notes as we speak. And we just want to say that we think they're doing a great job and good on you boys. And Aussie, Aussie, Aussie.
Oi, oi, oi.
But we're going to be covering, as we usually do, some nice light topics. Something that brings Australia together. I think that is celebratory, that we can be passionate about, but exciting, and that's quite important at this time of year, and that's Australia going to war, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like deja vu, Australia in Iraq in the 1990s with the Gulf War.
And Australia was there? I didn't think they were that involved in it. So they had some involvement, but not like... They're calling this the Third Gulf War.
Yeah, well, there was Western troops in the 90s with the Gulf War under old George Bush. Then 2000, 2003, there was the invasion of Iraq by the newer George Bush. And now, you know, every decade, you know, Western troops back in there. Well, back in the Middle East anyway, talking about going into Iraq and Syria. Australia has sent over 600 troops, 600 defence personnel to the Middle East, and yeah, possibly going into Iraq and Syria. So to join us, we're very lucky to have awesome independent journalist Anthony Lowenstein talking about this possible invasion of Iraq and Syria, the history behind it, as we've touched on. Also, this recent terror threat, which we're going to cover more on the episode, next episode, but Anton touches this a little bit in terms of there's been, for those who haven't kept up with it, like those outside Australia, there was a, you know, possible terror threat that was said to be stopped by, you know, police. Someone was apparently going to do a public beheading, and there was also someone who went into a police station, stabbed the police officers and was shot themselves, and there's been a big, you know, threat
shot
of terrorism.
Dead.
Yeah, shot dead, and then, you know, the terror threat has been raised in Australia. So we're going to cover that in detail, and the new counter-terror law is going to come in detail next episode. Anthony Lowenstein touches a bit in the interview, and also he's a journalist, so he talks a lot about the media coverage of, you know, this intervention, whatever you want to call it, into Iraq and Syria, and also of the media coverage of this terrorism stuff as well. We opened up with the song Everybody's Gone to War by Narina Pillow, which is quite a good anti-war song, I think.
Narina Pallet.
Yeah, whatever, however you say it. And we also wanted to apologise. We've been talking about doing the episode on sex work for ages, but we're pushing
the follow-up
back.
One.
Yeah, we'll push that back a little bit. We're going to cover these recent, you know, these kind of really topical issues, and then we will get back to that eventually. So this intervention is framed in humanitarian terms, and yeah, I wanted to break that down a little bit, and maybe to start things off, I've been listening to The Hunger Games, as Katie mentioned, and it's quite interesting.
When did I mention Hunger Games?
Oh, I think you mentioned the last episode. I've been reading The Hunger Games.
Oh yeah, and you're up to the second book.
Yeah, and in the second book, there's maybe a spoiler alert, I guess, for those who haven't read it, but yeah, there's a little discussion between...
it's not that much of a spoiler.
No, it's not really. Between Katniss, the main character, and President Snow, who's the president of the capital, and basically saying...
And he also controls all the districts.
Yeah, exactly. And basically he's saying, well, we're controlling the districts for the benefit of the districts. Like, we care so much, and if they became free, it would be so bad for them. So even though he just wants control of these districts, he's saying it's all for their own good.
And if a girl from District 12, of all places, can defy the capital and walk away unharmed, what is to stop them from doing the same? He says, what is to prevent, say, an uprising? It takes a moment for his last sentence to sink in. Then the full weight of it hits me. There have been uprisings? I ask, both chilled and somewhat elated by the possibility. Not yet. But they'll follow if the course of things doesn't change. And uprisings have been known to lead to revolution. President Snow rubs a spot over his left eyebrow, the very spot where I myself get headaches. Do you have any idea what that would mean? How many people would die? What conditions those left would have to face? Whatever problems anyone may have with the capital, believe me when I say that if it released its grip on the districts for even a short time, the entire system would collapse. I'm taken aback by the directness and even the sincerity of this speech. As if his primary concern is the welfare of the citizens of Panem, when nothing could be further from the truth.
I think we can link this to humanitarian intervention, the fact that, you know, the Australian government says they care so much about Iraq, and that's always the line. It's always, oh, we're going in there for the benefit of the Iraqi people or you know, whoever. There's always this humanitarian justification, but I don't think that's been the result of any of these interventions that have happened, and I think that's partly because I don't think that was ever their goal in the first place. And, yeah, if the Abbott government did care so much about the people of Iraq, and if that's supposedly why they're going in there, then why would they have cut all foreign aid to Iraq? So the Abbott government prepared to commit $500 million to military intervention in Iraq, but earlier in the year they decided that every single cent would be too much direct aid for Iraq. And there's
some... Cut it to zero.
Yeah, article from newmatilda.com, they're saying that their Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has confirmed that they have removed the development aid to zero. So again...
You know, not to mention they destroyed AusAid, Australia's aid agency, yeah, completely.
Yeah, and so yeah, it's like, oh, so do we really believe them that they're doing this for the benefit of the people of Iraq? So... Yeah, I mentioned 600 defence personnel going to the Middle East, and Attorney General George Brandis has said, he said Australia is not at war. He's describing the situation as humanitarian mission with military elements.
Very nice phrasing.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I know that a lot of the, when we were watching the Q&A episode the other week, which was quite good, and a lot of the tweets were like humanitarian mission with guns and stuff like that. And yeah, another article from newmatilda.com, they're saying, well, yeah, they're not sure if this will produce humanitarian outcomes. And if it, you know, if we think of truly humanitarian missions, generally features medical supplies and food drops.
UN peacekeepers.
Yeah, not troops and planes so much.
Airstrikes.
Exactly, yeah. Humanitarian missions undertaken to save the lives of people in danger, they are not on the whole pursued for reasons of national security to do with foreign insurgencies. So, yeah, it's kind of all the language is all mixed up. They're using that humanitarian justification, but I don't think we should necessarily take that on face value.
I mean, how much is Australia committing to the humanitarian mission of the Ebola crisis?
Yeah, that for example.
You know, killed thousands of people and has seen very little aid from the West.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, at the end of the interview, Andy Lowenstein talked about it's often framed in like, we either do nothing or we invade the country. And like, there's so many things in between that could be done to help the people of Iraq, such as not cutting their aid. And not only would this, you know, help the people, but also independent MP and former intelligence analyst and Iraq War whistleblower Andrew Wilkie has said that this decision to cut development of the country could be a deadly mistake. So he's saying it is self-evident that one of the foundations for peace in a country is nation building, and to help a country establish the basic needs of the community: medical care, education, law and order, economic development. Because if you provide a community with all of those needs, they are far less likely to become radicalized and far less susceptible to the influence of troublemakers. So, yeah, they say not only is it good to help the people, but also in terms of actually preventing terrorism, like, these kind of measures could do a lot more, a lot better than bombing civilians, which generally happens when we have these foreign interventions.
And what's interesting about this mission is that it is supported by Arab states like Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Jordan, and that was seen as very important on BBC World News, Global News. They were talking about, we can't just have another war of Americans going in and telling the world how to do things. It's important to have the Arab states. But then when the BBC tried to interview them, only the leader from Jordan was willing to speak to them about it. They were all very quiet wanting to speak to it. Because it's interesting, like, if you, like, sitting in the Human Rights Council at the UN and the Arab nations, you know, are on the whole condemning, sitting usually along very different lines to what America is saying. But in this case, they're getting those support, even though a lot of the foreign fighters, 75%, are coming from the Middle East and Arab countries, like the ones that are fighting with ISIS. But Russia and Iran, you know, they've criticized it, saying that the US should not have launched strikes without the permission of the Syrian government. So there's a question about how are they working with the actual people and the government here on what they're doing. But as a result of the UN Security Council meeting, it's interesting because David Cameron, the UK Prime Minister, said he would reconvene Parliament just to talk about this, and saying that the Greens, particularly Scott Ludlam, have been campaigning on at the moment is that, unlike many other Western democracies, Tony Abbott makes a decision about whether Australia goes to war or not. David Cameron needs to get the approval of Parliament. Tony Abbott can just call the shots.
Also, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, and Anthony Lowenstein touches on that during the interview as well, the fact that, yeah, we're all about opposing human rights abuses, yet Saudi Arabia is such an ally of the West.
Well, we're not all about opposing human rights abuses.
Well, that's supposedly in terms of, like, humanitarian intervention, like, how can we let this stuff go on?
Yeah, yeah, we inflict it on, you know, asylum seekers, refugees, and Indigenous people, of course, but we're not talking about that,
yeah,
naturally. It's interesting because the UN Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution which would make it illegal for state citizens to travel and support the hardline extremist movement. So that's a, you know, I can imagine it's not too controversial to get that passed. Okay, we're not going to let our citizens go over there. But it's interesting because there wasn't that much dissent. One of the few voices of dissent came from the Argentine president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, and she criticised the international response to the Islamic State threat in Iraq and Syria, particularly the US-led mission, which is to arm and train Syrian rebels at camps in Saudi Arabia. And she referred other historical missions, like promoting military aid to Saddam Hussein's government in the 80s, mm-hmm. which the US did, and how it also armed the Afghan Mujahideen against Soviet invaders. And they said that, she said that this mission paved the way for the creation of groups such as Al-Qaeda. And she said, the way that we've been fighting terrorism has not been up to the job, but something is not working. The only thing cannibals can't do is eat themselves, adding that the UN must understand that terrorism seeks to create a reaction from its adversaries that mirrors its own philosophy of violence and bloodshed.
Yeah, now Anthony Lowenstein touches that during the interview, the fact that otherwise, like, oh, we're kind of arming the good guys, but often there's like a fine line, like, yeah, and like Saddam Hussein, he's a good guy, then all of a sudden he's a bad guy, even though when he was committing his worst acts, like the violence, atrocities against the Kurdish people, that's when he was their ally.
Yeah.
And then later, oh, he's really bad, like he was still bad then, but actually, yeah, he committed his worst acts when he was an ally, and often these people people who are, yeah, these are the good guys. They're not necessarily that great, that much better than the group they're trying to get rid of. So anyway, let's go to the interview with Anthony Lowenstein, touching on all these issues on Australia going back into the Middle East, on these new terrorism situation in Australia, and the poor state of the media coverage of all of these issues, at least in the mainstream media.
To start things off, I put the call out for questions for you on Twitter, and we did get a few questions, which I thought we could maybe start with. A couple of tweets, one from Jarapilla said, "If we don't put some goddamn boots in the ground, how the hell are we supposed to find them dang missing weapons of mass destruction?" And also another tweet from Jen was, "Why don't more people seem to be concerned that Australia is going down the path of the US post 2003? And a lot of people probably get those references, but for those new to politics or younger people, whatever, and this is kind of the first time they're hearing about Australia going into Iraq, maybe you talk about the history, which makes probably people like us quite sceptical about this new adventure into Iraq.
Yeah, obviously I'll give a brief summary because there's so much that can be said. I mean, Australia's been into Iraq on a war footing for a number of years. Of course, there was the first Gulf War in the 1990s where the US essentially went into or took on Saddam Hussein, who was then the leader of Iraq, the dictator of Iraq, who of course had been backed by the US before he was a bad boy and turned against Washington. Australia joined in with that so-called global coalition to get Iraq out of Kuwait. Fast forward to 2003, and of course that was 2 years after September 11, the terrorist attack on Washington and New York, and the Bush administration, George W. Bush, who was then the US president, decided to launch a war against Saddam Hussein and Iraq under the guise of apparently protecting the world from weapons of mass destruction, which was never found. And initially what happened in that war was Saddam was overthrown, as it was in the Taliban in Afghanistan. One of the things that a lot of people who look at US military power and history regularly comment on is, initially at least, the US has the most powerful military in the world. It can pretty much destroy pretty much any enemy. However, and this of course is a massive however, what we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere is America has no idea how to fight a guerrilla war, has no idea how to fight an insurgency. We saw that in Vietnam, we saw it in Iraq, we saw it in Afghanistan. So the reason, which is often not talked about, why there is now such a crisis in Iraq and why we are told that we need to go back into Iraq and indeed into Syria as well, is clearly an effect, a very obvious ramification of the devastation that we in the West caused in Iraq from 2003 onwards. Many of the leaders, the fighters, the key personnel of ISIS, the terrorist group that is now occupying much of Iraq and Syria, fought against the Americans in Iraq after 2003. In fact, the leader himself, Baghdadi, was imprisoned and tortured by Americans in Iraq years after the 2003 election, hardening his position against the West and against America in particular. So the context, very much without going into too much detail, is that history continues to repeat over and over and over again. The difference, I guess, is that there are more and more people who are aware of it now. Now, one of those tweeters said, why are more people not caring about this? Why is this happening over and over again? It's a complex question. The short answer, I guess, to that, I would say, is that we have a political and media class that, generally speaking, speaks to itself. So although there is no doubt the number of people in the Australian public worry about terrorism, they worry about terrorism and the threat of a terrorist attack or some kind of other terrorist action because the media and the government daily tells them they should. I think ultimately, though, we need to be more cautious and much more sceptical about why all of a sudden, now let's not forget, literally 2 months ago, the vast majority of people in the West had never heard of ISIS. No one had heard of this organization. Within the space of a month, it had gone from being relatively unknown to apparently the threat worse than Nazism, and George Brandis, the Attorney General, said this week in Parliament that we're now facing a struggle stronger and worse than the Cold War. I mean, the level of hysteria is so crazy, and the media, sadly, with some notable exceptions, is playing along.
So you touched on the US alliance. This invasion, like, you know, like most Western invasions, are kind of being grounded in humanitarian terms, like we're doing it for the good of the people there. But in your article recently published on The Guardian, you spoke about this as more being a role of a dutiful US client state rather than, you know, a humanitarian invasion. Do you want to talk a little bit about that alliance and how we're kind of following the US rather than kind of making an independent decision that this is the best decision for the people in the area?
Yeah, I mean, consecutive leaders in Australia, whether they're the Labor or Liberal Party, routinely talk about humanitarian intervention, that we're actually going into Iraq and Syria now to help the Syrian and Iraqi people. The truth of the matter is that Australia's role in this is minimal at best. We are doing this to simply go along with the US, as we always do. One of the things I tried to explain in my Guardian piece, and I've done elsewhere, is where does that blind, dutiful support in much of the media and government come from? And I talked about the role of a US lobby that routinely invites and romances and takes various journalists and politicians on trips to America, off-the-record chats, ties into the Israel lobby, where you have a lot of individuals who are routinely taken to Israel and basically given talking points, and far too rarely are those individuals, journalists and politicians, actually questioning those talking points. Doesn't say much for their intelligence. I think it's also important to note that the idea that we're essentially going into Iraq and frankly also likely to be Syria, or America's already bombing Syria now, to bring humanitarian assistance is a complete fallacy, where the whole idea behind the Obama administration's plan, backed up blindly by Tony Abbott here and Bill Shorten for that matter, is that we're going to be funding, training, arming so-called Syrian moderates and an Iraqi army. And what most of the media is not talking about is the US spent years and literally billions of dollars training, arming and funding an Iraqi military. Years. That was one of the key aims of the Bush administration's war, and indeed the Obama administration's war. A few months ago, when ISIS was coming into Mosul, which is the second largest city in Iraq after Baghdad, the Iraqi army melted away. They didn't even fight. So we have to ask ourselves, wait a minute, we're basically going back into Iraq to support an Iraqi army that we spent billions on supporting in the first place, who for a range of reasons wouldn't and couldn't fight. Now we're going to be doing it again, and that's going to work the second time, which is lunacy. And in Syria, it's important to note, despite what Tony Abbott and Bill Shorten say, there arguably are no Syrian moderates. This is an expression the media likes to sort of repeat ad nauseum. The idea of moderates we have in the West is someone who kind of has political allegiances in a kind of center of the political spectrum. The truth of the matter is, since the Syrian civil war started about 3.5 years ago, the vast, vast bulk of fighters against Bashar al-Assad, the dictator of Syria, have been Islamists of various persuasions, some more extreme, some less so. But certain journalists like Patrick Coburn, who is a great British journalist for the UK Independent, has been reporting on this issue for a long time and says it's a complete myth to believe that we're going to be able to go into Syria and somehow support and arm and train moderates when it's virtually impossible to know who's a moderate and who's an extremist. They change allegiances so constantly. So just in closing, the Guardian piece, I was trying to argue that the Australian elite, both the media and politicians, like to frame our role as somehow important. We are simply latching ourselves onto a completely failed and not thought out of plan by the Obama administration, which is unavoidably going to continue long after he's actually left office. He finishes his term in a couple of years. And it's a shame that so few in the press in Australia have actually seriously questioned those motives.
You've touched on the media's role quite a bit already, but definitely, you know, watching the media report on both this, you know, invasion of Iraq and Syria and also the recent terror raids and that kind of thing, I really can see what you're talking about when you gave a talk around the Prophets of Doom book, when you're talking about how the media just repeats government press releases. And while there are exceptions to that, like The Guardian and New Matilda and these websites who are providing a more critical perspective and actually, you know, investigating these claims, it seems like most of the media out there, the bigger media that's reaching more people, they're just simply repeating the government's claims without actually looking into them and criticising that. I guess maybe it goes back to commercial constraints, like it's much cheaper just to repeat these points. But yeah, do you have any thoughts on the state of the media, I guess, at the moment?
Well, frankly, without wishing to go on too long a rant, so I'll keep this quite short. I think the media's performance has been an absolute disgrace. There are notable exceptions. I do say that, I don't have to say this because I work for them, but The Guardian, I think, has done some really important investigative work. And there are good journalists at the ABC and Fairfax and elsewhere. I'm not saying that, you know, the entire media is hopeless. There are good journalists doing good work. But overall, the message that an average reader or viewer or listener will see and hear is mass hysteria. Complete mass hysteria, complete acceptance of a government narrative. And the reason this is happening, and we see time and time and time again, it happened since 9/11 on a range of different issues. It started before 9/11, of course, but is that the majority of the corporate press are embedded with the state. It's not some conspiracy theory, it's the way in which that relationship operates. Their worlds are very symbiotic. They spend a lot of time with each other, whether it's ministers or advisors or journalists. So the information that we're often receiving, we so-called see this expression exclusive story about terror raids last week in Sydney or elsewhere, is that most of that is basically a press release, maybe rewritten, with little or no reporting. Most of the corporate press has little or no connection in the Muslim or Islamic community. Although they've had years and years and years and years to develop some kind of relationship, some kind of connection, some kind of understanding about what Muslims may be thinking, doing or saying, when something like this happens, they're completely flat-footed, and the result is they essentially just publish either complete bollocks, or speaking to a very young, active Muslim citizen just before, I'm doing a piece for The Guardian next week, he's an active 25-year-old Muslim convert, who's sort of, apart from the fact he's appalled what's happening in the Middle East and is vehemently against what ISIS is doing, he looks at the media coverage and says, why should I, as a young Muslim, why am I somehow expected to condemn outrageous behavior by other Muslims? Do we go around asking young Catholics to condemn the actions of Catholic priests who abuse children? I mean, or do we go around, for example, demanding Jews condemn every action by Israel? I mean, this idea somehow is absurd. And yet, the way the media routinely reports this is so hysterical that it's not surprising that many Australians in recent polling, although they're sceptical and critical of some of the claims, fear a terrorist attack here. And they fear it because the media is telling them that the chances are very, very high that it's going to happen. And maybe it does happen. And of course, I very much hope it doesn't. God forbid that it happens anywhere in Australia, committed by a Muslim or to anyone for that matter. So the media, I think,'s role is so central, and yet most of them are failing because they actually don't see their role, despite what they claim, as being anything other than a government mouthpiece. And this has happened now so often for so many years, particularly since 9/11, so at least 13 years now. But it's not just an accident anymore, it's deliberate. This is how corporate state media works. It works to amplify and encourage the role of the state. So when there's some kind of terror hysteria, they see it as a logical extension that they would simply report blindly what the government says. The fact that, as one very short example, I'll finish on this. Yesterday, lead story in Sydney was that a member of the Australian Defence Force had allegedly been approached by men of Middle Eastern appearance, his language, not mine, and assaulted. Lead story, framed in a way that suggested the Muslims are coming and attacking our soldiers. Today, what do we find? In much lesser and smaller coverage, oh, actually, sorry, that individual has retracted that allegation. Sorry about that. No, actually, there was no serious assault by anyone against the ADF. Right. And I can assure you that the way that it's going to be covered today and in tomorrow's press is far, far less in the initial allegation yesterday. The point being that you can understand where I'm going with this, that the average citizen sees that and goes, oh my God, crazy Muslims are attacking their army people. Let's go out and fight them in the Middle East before they come and fight us here. Whereas, in fact, the media routinely, without doing any basic checks, repeats this kind of crap ad nauseum, and it's really problematic.
What I wanted to finish on is, you know, a lot of the time when people are criticising, you know, going into Iraq and Syria, they'll say, oh, well, yeah, it's bad, but the alternative of, like, not doing anything is even worse. So I'm just wondering, you touched on your this in your piece on The Guardian about there are plenty of alternatives, but do you want to, yeah, just finish with some alternatives so I guess we're not just criticising what they're doing but looking at some alternatives as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one of the things that's always weird about this kind of argument, and we heard this with Afghanistan in 2001 and Iraq in 2003, was, well, if we shouldn't invade, what should we do? Is this somehow, there's only two options. We either invade and occupy their country, or we don't. I mean, this is an absurd kind of suggestion. One of the things that I talked about in my piece, and a number of other people have said, the idea somehow that there's only two options here, that we go into Iraq, what we're doing anyway, and Syria, bombing them ad nauseum, which is exactly what ISIS wants, I might add. And this is exactly what Al-Qaeda wanted. Bin Laden, before 9/11, talked very clearly about his desire to entrap the West, and America particularly, in a long-term battle in the Middle East. Although Bin Laden is now dead, he got his wish, because America is now completely entrapped in this unwinnable kind of battle. How do you deal with ISIS? Well, there's a number of different things you can do. One, you actually need to empower local forces on the ground. And that's not what actually we're doing. We talk about doing that, and we talk about actually assisting, say, local Arab individuals or groups. But we're doing that by arming them. We're not doing that by actually finding a way and some kind of political solution. Secondly, to blindly support and empower Arab regimes to assist in the bombing, these are exactly the regimes that are repressing their own people, which give legitimacy to ISIS by saying, you guys are all living under US client states. We are living a truly Islamic life. Now, I'm not arguing that's what ISIS is, but that's what they say. So until the US and the West actually finds a way and chooses to empower local Arab communities who are not simply Arab regimes, this will continue to happen time and time again. Thirdly, and arguably most importantly, one of the key sources of terrorism in the world is Saudi Arabia. It's not my opinion, it's the opinion of countless experts for decades. Saudi Arabia is one of America's and the West's closest allies. Saudi Arabia routinely beheads people for a range of crimes, including witchcraft. I mean, this is one of our close allies, and yet we're so outraged when ISIS beheads journalists. We should be outraged by both. So until we actually manage in a kind of mature way, and you all know why we're supporting Saudi, because of its oil, that's clear. But it's a really sad state of affairs that we actually can't have a serious discussion, and no one mentions it. Obama doesn't, Abbott doesn't, David Cameron doesn't, Hollande in France. No one mentions the actual role of Saudi. And it's clear that, in fact, a lot of the funding for ISIS in the last years has come from elements within the Saudi regime and also the Qatari regime, both close US client states. So there's some of the things which are not going to be done, so we're going to repeat history and be back here in 10 years again. Let's hope there is some alternative found in the coming while.
Let's hope so. But either way, thanks so much for your time and for all the work you do. Actually, again, as we've said, actually challenging these claims from the government rather than just accepting them on face value. Could you give your just website or Twitter, anything else you want to promote that you'd like listeners to look into?
My website is antonylowenstein.com, antonylowenstein.com. You can find me on Twitter, it's just @AntLowenstein, and I write a weekly column for The Guardian. If you just go to The Guardian website and put my name in, you'll find my work there.
All right, great. We definitely encourage people to check all that out, and we'll put links to all of that in our show notes on our website as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Cheers. Thanks for your time.
And, of course, we'll also link to Anthony Lowenstein's article from The Guardian that we referred to, so check that out. And you can also hear more from Anthony Lowenstein on our 41st episode, where he spoke about his book, Prophets of Doom, and also more generally, where next for the Australian left. That is well worth checking out. And, yeah, check out his website. All his books are well worth looking into. And for the interview with Anthony Lowenstein, I did something new. I posted on Twitter and Facebook asking people for questions, and we got to a few of them in there, a few of the tweets, but a few we didn't get to. And this was one tweet they asked us to ask Anthony Lowenstein about. I didn't get a chance to fit in the interview, but I thought Katie would be a good person to ask about this, being a lawyer. So Dr. Andrew Watt said, ask if proposed airstrikes are terrorism under UK law, see Section 1 of the Terrorism Act 2000.
So the Act defines terrorism as the use or threat of action designed to influence the government or an international governmental organisation, or to intimidate the public or a section of the public, and the use of a threat that's made for the purpose of advancing a political, religious, racial or ideological issue. So it has to be action involving serious violence against a person, serious damage to property, endangering a person's life, other than that of the person committing the action, like suicide bombers, creating a serious risk to the health and safety of the public or a section of the public, or is designed to seriously interfere with or seriously disrupt an electronic system. That's interesting. Disrupting an electronic system.
Yeah.
Hackers.
Yeah, that's true. That's why that's pretty bad.
Hackers,
yeah.
If they're doing it for a political reason, ideological cause, it's fairly broad. Includes action outside the United Kingdom. That's what I was wondering, if they're even in the UK, but no, outside the UK.
Yeah.
It can be a reference to a country other than the UK. The government means the government of the UK or a government other than the country of the UK. So, yeah, I think absolutely.
I mean, definitely, you know, if they do airstrikes, would involve serious violence against a person, would involve serious damage to property, will endanger people's lives. So I can see lots of places where it would apply to that definition. So it could well be terrorism. And it's quite interesting that it's governments who usually set the definition of terrorism. So they
Governments who will always set it in if it's in legislation.
Yeah.
If that comes from cases.
Yeah.
If you're in a common law system, then it's, you know, the judges.
Well, yeah, I was thinking like not always, because also like United Nations or whatever, and that is just a collection of states anyway. But yeah, because it's generally states have so much power in defining terrorism, often they kind of get themselves off the hook. Like the definition could be like influencing a government, but that means that the government themselves is kind of beyond being charged with terrorism or labelled a terrorist because they set the definition.
You'd say it's to intimidate the public, and you could count ISIS as having a government, because the state is not officially recognised, but they're proclaiming that they are a state. They just haven't been recognised as a state.
Mm-hmm.
They're being categorised as a terrorist group by the UN and the US and many other countries. But yeah, absolutely, I think that does fall into that definition.
Yeah. And let's go to a track now. This is Low-Key Terrorist, and this is all about him being charged under terror laws in the
and
UK.
And his family's from Iraq?
Yeah, yeah. His family came in the 70s. He was born in the UK, but his parents are both from Iraq. And yeah, so got Iraqi heritage. And yeah, charged under these terrorist acts. And he was never, you know, kind of charged or anything, but he was banned from the City of London during the royal wedding or royal visit or something like
Wow.
But yeah, and just basically just question this, like, what is the definition of terrorism? I'm talking about these people who have like so much power in labeling terrorism, like the US government, like the UK government, could well be accused of committing terrorists themselves, because they are, you know, bombing civilians, they are causing fear, they are, you know, damaging property if it's defined in that way. And so yeah, they are doing all these things which could easily be claimed as terrorism.
So we must ask ourselves, what is the dictionary definition of terrorism? The systematic use of terror, especially as a means of coercion. But what is terror? According to the dictionary I hold in my hand, terror is violent or destructive acts, such as bombing, committed by groups in order to intimidate a population or government into granting their demands. So what's a terrorist?
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terrorist. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love.
Like the rag heads and packies are worrying your dad, but your dad's favourite food is curry and kebab. It's funny but it's sad how they make your mummy hurry with her bags, rather read the sun and study all the facts. Tell me, what's the bigger threat to human society? BAE systems or homemade IEDs, remote controlled drones killing off human lives, or man with homemade bomb committing suicide? I know you were terrified when you saw the towers fall. It's all terror, but some forms are more powerful. It seems nuts, how could there be such agony when more Israelis die from peanut allergies? It's like the definition didn't ever exist. I guess it's all just dependent who your nemesis is. Irrelevant how eloquent the rhetoric peddler is. They're telling fibs, now tell us who the terrorist is.
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terrorist. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love.
us, and that was democracy, and there was democracy. Hypocrisy, it bothers me. Call you terrorists if you don't want to be a colony. Refuse to bow down to a policy of robberies. Terrorism, my lyrics. When more Vietnam vets kill themselves after the war than die in it, this is very basic. One nation in the world has over 1,000 military bases. They say it's religion when clearly it isn't. It's not just Muslims that oppose your imperialism. Is Hugo Chavez a Muslim? Nah, I didn't think so. Is Castro a Muslim? Nah, I didn't think so. It's like the definition didn't ever exist. I guess it's all just dependent who your nemesis is. Irrelevant how eloquent the rhetoric peddler is. They're telling fibs, now tell us who the terrorist is.
They're calling me a terrorist, like they don't know who the terrorist. When they put it on me, I tell them this, I'm all about peace and love.
Phosphorus that burns hands, that is terrorism. Erdogan and Stern gang, that was terrorism. What they did in Hiroshima was terrorism. What they did in Fallujah was terrorism. Mandela, ANC, they call terrorism. Jerry Adams, IRA, they call terrorism. Eric Prince, Blackwater was terrorism. Oklahoma, McVeigh, that was terrorism. Every day USA, that is terrorism. Every day UK, that is terrorism.
A new subscription. I think we need to do a David Brent quote. Timothy! So thanks to Timothy for $5 a month subscription.
Don't know how that will look in the show notes. Probably look Timothy! Very similar to Timothy. Yeah.
With an exclamation point.
Okay, sure.
And in brackets, David Brent voice.
So thanks a lot to Tim. He's giving us ongoing Timothy! Donation. Like
you have to say it, Nick.
Timothy!
No, but thanks a lot to...
Thanks a lot to Timothy!
Nah, that's shit. Oh, thanks whatever. A lot to Timothy!
Yeah, you got it. So he's doing monthly donations. So if anyone wants to do that, just get in touch with us and we'll set that up for you. So thanks a lot to Timothy for doing that. We appreciate the ongoing support. And yeah, again, if you want to do that as well, contact us. And generally, if you want to become a member of the show, go to progressivepodcastaustralia.com and click on the membership button. And there are a bunch of patches we're keen to give out that you can sew on or iron on to shirts.
For members, yeah. For our second year of membership.
Yep.
You get a patch, which you can do whatever you want with. That sounds dirty.
Or it sounds like, you know, within the confines of ASIO, limiting what you do with your patch. But, yeah. So on our last episode, we spoke about Thailand and some of the issues going on there that we kind of witnessed and looked into from going there. And the picture of our last episode is someone reading the book 1984 by George Orwell. That's the picture of the last episode. And yeah, we spoke about the way in which this book has been banned because it's been a symbol of political protest against the military regime that seized power in May. But also something we didn't actually read in the last episode that's worth mentioning, that anti-coup protesters have staged silent readings of this book, 1984, as an act of resistance against a military junta. And there's been at least one arrest of a person reading this book in public. So in June, a man was dragged away by half a dozen undercover police officers while reading 1984 outside an upscale shopping mall in Bangkok. So yeah, it's quite interesting just when we think about protests, often thought about this narrow way. And this is like a really kind of creative protest, reading 1984 in public. So
brave.
Yeah, very brave, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I still can't believe, like, one of the man that got shot when he stabbed the two police officers, he had been earlier that day handing out flyers about Islam, wearing a...
military outfit, wasn't it?
Yeah, what do you call it? A balaclava.
Oh, okay.
On his face in a military outfit.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like, that's kind of, like... That happens and, yeah, police get called and they get taken away. This is people reading 1984.
Yeah.
Not people promoting a radical view of Islam and wearing like balaclavas and everything. Can you imagine like someone reading 1984 in a shopping centre here and being dragged away?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, obviously,
not until these new terror laws are introduced, am I right?
Well, yeah, though there has been some horrific targeting of Muslim people or people of Middle Eastern appearance, which has been appalling. But just that one example is like someone reading 1984 and kind of getting dragged away.
Yeah, exactly. And it shows how repressive it is. And we did say it is kind of on the surface, it does seem like business as usual.
Well, we weren't in Bangkok at the same time.
Yeah, we were on like a tourist, you know, Phuket, touristy island. So, yeah.
It's very different.
Not the most political place.
So they waived a lot of the restrictions on the tourist island, so they want the tourism back.
Yeah. We also got some feedback from Luke on this episode saying, great episode, and also wanted to share an article regarding our discussion on trans issues. And we spoke about gender being a social construct, but this article is shared with us, argues that sex is also a social construct as well.
That's interesting because...
biological sex.
Yeah, and Stevie also recommended something a bit more academic.
Yeah, so we'll link to the Facebook post so you can see both this article and also the other ones that Stevie and other people shared there on this issue.
But I hope that this message makes its way across in... because, I mean, this is what I was taught in high school, in... university, yeah, I wasn't doing like gender and sexuality diversity studies. I'm sure they'd be a lot more progressive, but yeah, that's just what I was taught. And you as well, Nick,
yeah,
right? That's what you're taught in sociology.
Yeah, and I've taught it myself. Yeah. So
you're going to have to correct some of your lecture slides. Yeah,
exactly.
So yeah, that's really interesting because a lot of people don't match up the traditional XY, XX kind of thing and how, yeah, I guess like when you start to think of how so many people are born like intersex or indeterminate gender, that does start to make sense.
Exactly, yeah. They raise the intersex issue and also other ones. It's not purely because of intersex issue, but intersex is one example which challenges that idea of sex being so straightforward and biological and, yeah.
And that's, yeah, the article that Luke linked to has a biologist and a geneticist talking about it. They've got a PhD... that gives them extra credibility. So, Nick, you always know what you're talking about, don't you?
In theory.
They said very few people actually fit into the binary in these different five categories, like hormones, gonads, genitalia, chromosomes, and secondary sex characteristics, which is kind of the look of your skin and your hips and your waist and facial hair and all those kinds of things.
We also got some feedback from Jeremy, but we'll read that next episode because we want to do the next episode pretty soon, so we probably won't get much feedback before we release that, so we'll just spread the feedback over that episode as well. And so we want to finish the episode talking about another direct action in Melbourne, kind of talking about resisting. This isn't about resisting specifically, you know, military intervention in Iraq and Syria, but we had Sam Castro on episode 65 talking about direct action for Gaza, and there's actually been another direct action in Melbourne.
Yeah, so Melbourne activists shut down the world's largest global war profiteer, Lockheed Martin. So it's not just about Gaza, but general anti-war stuff, shutting down the two buildings of Lockheed Martin, which is amazing. They'd locked down the access gates, dropped a banner on the building saying Medicare, not warfare, scrap the F-35 deal. And another banner was attached from Princess Highway, or could be seen from Princess Highway, saying war profiteers, your tax dollars making a killing. The F-35 refers to Australia. Our federal government has handed over $35 billion of taxpayer money to acquire a fleet of F-35 aircraft from Lockheed, widely reputed to be technological lemons, while attempting to convince the Australian community to sacrifice their free at the point of service medical system, which is a foundation stone of the community and well-being.
And they had someone dressed as a lemon to signify that, which is quite cool.
That's so, really good.
Yeah, we'll put up links to articles. You can see all the pictures from the actions. They had like blood or fake blood, you know, down there, and they're hosing it off, and they'll say you'll need more than water to get the blood off Lockheed Martin's hands. So yeah, another very creative and very cool action from activists in Melbourne. Thanks to Cogo for letting us know about this, and Wacker, who we had on episode 65, in check that out, all about their direct action for Gaza, and also discussion around direct action in general. That is, well worth checking out, and definitely look into this action as well. Yeah, check out the
pictures. We're going to need more of this anti-war action, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The demand for anti-war protests is not going down anytime soon.
No, exactly. So we spoke about in the last episode, like, not everyone can do direct action, but I think direct action can definitely play a role. But yeah, I guess do whatever you can with your ability and what you feel confident doing and what your strengths are, and whatever that involves, whether direct action or something else, you can oppose these foreign interventions.
So our next episode is going to be a follow-up to this, and we're going to talk about the new counter-terror laws in Australia. We're going to talk about the abhorrent Islamophobia. We'll play a bit of the Q&A, which was actually decent. Usually I can't stand Q&A.
Yeah, no, it was good.
We'll talk about it more. When they let through that fucking racist question, I'm like, what the fuck?
Yeah, that was shitty.
Our ABC. These people, they don't even watch ABC. ABC is watched by mostly like left-wing people or people who want to watch British comedy.
So please let us know if you have anything you'd like to cover on this episode. You might have articles about the laws, articles, examples of Islamophobia, or also like protests occurring against it. Gay sent us one which we shared. So yeah, let us know any protests going on against this stuff, all those stuff like we'll talk about the hashtag HeyAsio hashtag
trending.
It's been really good. So yeah, anything like that, anything you think we should cover on this episode, definitely get in touch with us, progressivepodcast@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Hopefully we've got some new listeners from Anthony Lowenstein's crew. So
it was awesome that he came on.
Yeah, he was very cool. I actually tweeted him tweeted him saying, do you want to come on the show?
And yesterday, then, right?
Yeah. And then a few hours later, I was on the phone to him. So yeah, he was very cool, replied right away.
Amazing.
And was very happy to come on. So thanks a lot to Anthony Lowenstein for joining
us. I really
want to
read his latest book.
Prophets of Doom?
Yeah.
He's definitely got heaps of
interesting stuff. That's my next one. I've got to read.
Yeah. And thanks to Timothy for sponsoring this episode. New listeners, if you are new to the show, you found us through Anthony Lowenstein, whatever, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or follow our blog at progressivepodcast.com.
If there's an issue that you're interested in or you run a group or something, then get in touch with us and something that we can cover.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to finish with another low-key song.
You're kind of over low-key now though, right? You haven't listened to him for a while.
Oh, I know, regularly.
You're more into Colour Me Wednesday. Now you listen to a little bit of Lily Allen.
Yeah.
Anything else?
Tuts,
yeah.
Frank Turner, still.
It took two gay men to get you listening to women. Finally.
Usually when I'm coming for songs for the episode, I'm something like this.
Can't think of another band full of dudes right now, but there were loads.
Mm. So that was Peep Show, one of our favourite sitcoms, Superhands. Yeah. Currently another band full of all dudes. Yeah, they're hard to come by.
So some great lyrics from this song are very relevant to what's happening right now. Saddam was bad, are the Americans even more so? So same with what's going on now. It's like, yeah, ISIS obviously bad, but you know, will this lead to actually more damage than ISIS are doing? You know, or at least it won't help the situation. Same with the sanctions going back. There were sanctions on Iraq years ago. And lost people died while the ruler's family lived in palaces and mansions. So it affected the people more than the leaders themselves,
and what,
their sanctions.
I mean, we usually often, unfortunately, see the same thing happening just generally with law reform. You do the research, you see what helps to reduce crimes, like intervention in parenting, welfare, education, good mental health, all those kind of things. And it's similar, we'll touch on this in the next episode, but one of the guests on Q&A saying, it's preventing isolation in the community, reaching out to these people, making them feel welcome when Islamophobia happens, and these kind of counterterrorism laws that create this hype and perpetuate this Islamophobia, it gets worse.
Yeah.
The rise of this radical fundamentalism and violence gets worse.
Yeah, and to use the language of Dr. Ann Alley, like what Katie's kind of advocating there is like what are called like soft measures towards terrorism, and hard measures are like monitoring people's emails and like doing raids and all this kind of more law enforcement.
Arrest you without a warrant, throw you in jail for 10 years if you whistleblower or report whistleblowing.
Exactly. And these like hard measures can kind of undermine the soft measures. So like they can they're supposed to prevent terrorism, but they can actually create
more terrorism.
We have to be
tough, right? And this is like, have we done our episode on criminal law yet?
No.
I still want to do it. Because when you study, study criminal justice, and what is in, what's it popular? They call it the popular punitive measures, right?
Mm-hmm.
To be punitive, to punish. That is what people want to hear. Yeah, fucking throw the pedophiles in jail, behead them, bring back the death penalty, blah, blah, blah. That's what everyone loves to say, stronger, harsher measures, which actually end up making things worse and increase the crime rate a lot of the time. And we're seeing the same thing again, because obviously Nick and I are against violence. We're against violence perpetuated by individuals, by the state. The constant legal violence that happens against animals and, like, refugees in detention here, we're completely against all this kind of horrible violence. But how about we do something that's effective and that research backs up that actually works to stop this kind of violence happening? And these, often these young men that become very isolated and get indoctrinated and everything. And you've got, you know, all the mainstream Islamic leaders in Australia are trying to stop this happening. But it's very hard for them to do that when they're, you have a government like where they targeted like three Middle Eastern men checking their phones when they had a football match.
Mm-hmm.
They were checking their phones suspiciously, which I think everyone's fucking looking at their phone 24/7. Yeah,
but they did in a suspicious way, which I don't know how looking at your phone.
I think because they're Middle Eastern. Yeah, that's the issue.
Looking at your phone while Muslim.
It's just like the absolute privilege that Nick and I have for being white.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't wear a hijab or a niqab or anything like that. And
no. Katie just wears a burqa. But no, but actually I was thinking that in the UK, like I was running to the train, like we were running late and I was sprinting down and I was wearing this big jacket because I hadn't got around to taking it off.
This is in the UK?
This is in the UK. And actually while I was running to this train, I was actually, it was flashing through my head. I'd actually done an essay on the Shoot to Kill policy in London. So I was kind of, I'd really looked into this issue and this man from Brazil had been shot dead by police in the UK for that exact same reason. Like he was running, he was wearing like too big clothes, like it was too warm. He was dressed too warmly, so he was suspicious. So they shot him with the Shoot to Kill policy. And actually as I was running to the train, I was like, no, like they're just going to think, oh, he's just running late for his train, you know, whereas if I had a different ethnicity, I mean, well, why is he running? Why is he wearing that jacket? They're a terrorist. Let's shoot him. So it is, you know, I was kind of like in that few seconds as I was running to the train, I was kind of, yeah, knowing that my privilege, the police aren't
going
to think that.
Or what's going on in Ferguson, you know, being an African-American, walking along the road, get off the road. Oh, I'm just, I will be in a sec.
Yeah.
Shot dead.
Yeah.
Several times. And this doesn't often happen in the UK because the gun laws are so different to the US, but then they had the Shoot to Kill policy.
Yeah, or even getting out to the airport in London, like I was greeted by
Operation
police massive guns.
Kratos, so. They called it Kratos. That policy continues,
yeah.
The Shoot to Kill practice.
I just wanted to give one more lyric from the low-key song. Bombings, occupation, torture, intimidation, a million dead people doesn't equal liberation. And again, linking it back to what's going on now, you know, obviously we want to help the people of Iraq, but I really just don't think this Western intervention is going to do it. Yeah, and Syria, I just don't think it's going to help these people there.
Well, I think what we need, like the Argentine president said, we need to rethink how we respond to this. Because we've mentioned before, people like to blame the UN. America loves to blame the UN. And you don't realise that if you're talking about the Security Council, US has a huge amount of power, veto power and control, along with the five other nations that also have that veto power. And so often the US, like I was reading about Rwanda, and it was just, you know, shocking because the UN peacekeepers are not allowed to intervene when people are, they have to have certain authorizations. They can't even intervene. They have to literally stand by and watch people being murdered. And it's just appalling. And it's, you know, we report on what's been happening in Central African Republic as well, the violence that's happening there. The UN needs reform, desperately needs reform. Humanitarian intervention, something that I did a research paper on and I did a law competition about as well, humanitarian intervention, because it's not something that is firmly established that, okay, you have to intervene, responsibility to protect, they call it. It's not firmly established as a must for everyone. It's not something that's in the treaty or anything like that. But we really have to have a rational, research-based approach to the best way to combat this violence. And in a way that is not just going to stir up all this horrible Islamophobia and, you know, like the Australian Defence League, we'll talk about that on the next episode as well, but this horrible right-wing group that are making threats of violence against Muslim women and their children. And why aren't they treated as terrorists?
Mm-hmm.
A guy went into a Islamic school in Sydney with a knife and the kids had to all hide under their desks. I didn't see the front page terrorism white person in Islamic school. You know, like Martin Bryant and those three men that these, like, lone wolf killers that have, it's only been three in the last few decades in Australia. Martin Bryant being the worst, who was then the catalyst for the gun reforms that Howard introduced. But even when there's white terrorists like the Oklahoma bomber and, yeah, like the terrorist attacks in Norway in 2011, two lone wolf terrorist attacks have one after the other, killing Workers' Youth League summer camp in Oslo.
Yeah, so politically motivated and violent.
Well, they're calling it terrorism as well.
Oh, okay.
No. But I'm just saying it's not, when it's a white person, it doesn't stir up that same kind of fear and hate and...
Yeah. Well, I think because, you know, again, we'll talk about this more in the next episode, but they can't be seen as an other because everyone interacts with white people, whereas Muslims are only 2% of the Australian population, so people might not have interacted as much with Muslims, so it's easier to portray them as like the boogeyman, I think.
One of the memes going around is like, it's like a woman, like an older woman in a headscarf, like, oh, this is like the most threatening thing in our society right now.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So go to progressivepodcastaustralia.com and you can find all of the links referred to throughout the episode.
Thanks so much to Anthony Lowenstein for coming on the show. That's really awesome. We'll be following up this issue more in the next episode, so you can always send us things through Facebook and Twitter, but we'll probably have that one out a bit quite quickly. So send it quickly through if there's things that you want us to cover on the next episode about the ASIO laws and Islamophobia. Also, I'd like to know if people would like to hear me and Nick doing singing some Frozen songs from the movie Frozen.
I vote no.
I've had a real desire to sing those songs, and it's a very positive message in that movie. And Nick agreed to sing a few with me. I was saying to Luke at Team Ethlin, Luke, we should sing these songs. Luke would actually like perform them, but Nick, you're happy to sing along with me. So if
Luke
anyone
would
like
actually like perform them, what was I doing then?
Well, I'm saying on stage.
Oh, I see, yeah.
So if people would like to hear, in these dark times, you need to take solace you can. If you'd like to hear me and Nick's really bad singing of a few Frozen songs, in which Nick, even with the words on the screen, still fails to sing.
Because I don't know when the words are going to come, like when they're meant
to. Then, let us know if you'd like to hear that. And
if you don't, let us know as well.
There's a special song that Charlie and Nick recorded together as well. Guest vocals from Charlie, so be in touch.
I remember when I was growing up, if my mother got angry or frustrated with me, she'd say, "Ishket helwa el harriya." Now the basic translation of that is, "Oh, how beautiful is freedom." But where is freedom? Place of my mother's birth, the cradle of civilization, for what it's worth. The land I've never seen, culture I've never known. Iraq is in my heart, my blood, my flesh and bones. The air I've never breathed, fragrance I've never smelt. Pride I've never had, the nationality that I've never felt. Saddam was bad, hardy Americans even more so. They made me grow like I was missing part of my torso. But I never picked up a grenade in my garden. I never saw people I love die starving. I never saw my family die through many years of sanctions, while the ruler's family lived in palaces and mansions. I never had a family member kidnapped for a ransom. I never lost a friend to violence that was random. Romans' occupation, torture, intimidation. A million dead people doesn't equal liberation. On ethnicity or religion, whether you're Sunni, Shia, Kurdish or Christian, pain is still pain if you're a person that's missing. We all deserve a life in this earth that we live in. Is there enough words that can say how deeply Baghdad is burning today? And it's not about pity, hands out or sympathy. It's about pride, respect, honor and dignity. Babies being born with the
Former East from uranium. Those babies aren't just Iraqi, they're Mesopotamian. What I view on the news is making me shiver, cause I look at the victims, see the same face in the mirror. This system of division makes it harder for you and me. Peace is a question, the only answer is unity. So many dreams about this place that I've never seen, the place my family had to leave in the 70s. White phosphorus in Fallujah. This is for those that won't live to see the future. I'm sorry that I wasn't there, sorry that I couldn't help. I'm sorry for every tear, sorry you've been put through hell. Still I feel like an immigrant, Englishman amongst Arabs, and an Arab amongst Englishmen. Like I said, they never gave me the culture, but they did give me covered halab, hakeka and dolma. And it is fikirin or amri talata Ishreen, Umimin, Baghdad, or Abu Yemen, Dover. And that's the combination that I carry on my shoulders. Still I rep till my death, till they kill and steal my flesh. From now, all the way back to Gilgamesh. Such a villainized and criticized nation. You will always be the cradle of civilization. Dreams, motherland, I can still feel you calling me in my sleep, in my dreams, motherland, I can still feel you calling me in my sleep, in my dreams, motherland, I can still feel you calling me, I can still feel you calling me, I can still feel you calling me.
What about me? Am I coming through? Emma?
If ASIO's tracking us, we're heading off to the Cash and Carry next. The union members get access to wholesale groceries. Join your local union. So we'll catch you down there, ASIO. It's a pretty big place, so, you know, nowhere to hide. But I'm sure you're... I don't have a brain.